district court erred when it failed to conduct the balancing analysis required under Federal Rules of Evidence 609 and 403 in response to my client's motion in limine to bar evidence of his prior convictions. As a result of this error, the defendants were able to portray my client as, quote, a seven-time convicted felon who will say or do anything to get money at this Section 1983 trial. Now, the parties agree that the district court erred. The only remaining dispute for this court is what it should do to address the error. The defendants say nothing should be done because the error was either forfeited or harmless.
Well, trial counsel, in that two-page motion, mentioned the probative prejudice balancing test. But where in the record did counsel actually explain why the probative value of the convictions was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice?
Your Honor, there is no such explanation. And while we recognize that Mr. Williams' prior counsel did not file a fulsome motion in the trial court, we think it did enough to put the defendants and the district court on notice of his basic argument. And we know this because the defendants filed a five-page response brief, which for three pages argued that the probative...
Well, of course, because they wanted to be thorough. And it seems to me you're arguing that it was preserved, your right to argue this was preserved, simply because your opponent addressed it defensively out of an abundance of caution, and then you didn't even... And there wasn't even a reply submitted to address that, right?
Your Honor, that is correct.
So if we rule that way, aren't we punishing your opponent for being diligent?
I don't think you are, Your Honor. I would point you to the authority from this circuit that has recognized that it is permissible for a party to raise a skeletal argument below and flesh it out on appeal, so long as the district court and the opposing party are not prejudiced in the proceedings below. So I believe that although it was not a fulsome effort, that no one was prejudiced by it.
Well, isn't the error harmless when there seem to be so many inconsistencies with Williams' testimony and where your briefs don't point to any similar problems with the officers?
Your Honor, I don't think that the error was harmless here. First off, I don't think that we should conduct a harmless error analysis. I believe that the circumstances here warrant automatic reversal. This court has recognized on multiple occasions that the district court's failure to completely conduct the 403 analysis, quote, may in itself be grounds for reversal. And we believe that the circumstances call for that result here. And the reason why is simple. There was a significant risk of prejudice in this case. As this court knows, it was a civil rights case under Section 1983, which this court has recognized often pits criminals against guardians of the community's safety. In cases like this, there's a real risk that the jury may think that the plaintiff provoked or deserved the treatment at issue. And that exact risk materialized here. The defendants highlighted my client's criminal history at every turn.
I don't see any objections to the statement in opening statement about the seven-time convicted felon or the other uses of these prior convictions other than the motion in limine.
That's correct, Your Honor. We believe that...
And I know you note that they highlighted it at every turn, but there was no further objection to it after the motion in limine.
But Your Honor,
said you weren't trial counsel.
We were trial counsel, but we were appointed after the motions.
After the motion.
Yeah. So there were no objections, Your Honor, but I think that was because we believe that the defense was within the parameters of the district court's order. In other words, saying that someone is a seven-time convicted felon is still within the parameters of an order that says you can reference the fact that this person has been convicted of seven felonies. So we don't think that they ran afoul of the district court's order, and we, you know, for strategic reasons, did not want to draw more attention to this issue on an objection that we would likely lose.
So you didn't you just didn't make the objection again or go to sidebar and make a standing objection to references to this conviction?
Your Honor, we did not. But
that's what can be done, so you don't have to do it in front of the jury. Just go to sidebar, advise the court, have a standing objection. Anytime it comes up, it's part of the record.
That did not happen, Your Honor, but again, I would repeat that we don't think that the defense ran afoul of the order in the first place.
The,
so
the order admitted the convictions to the extent they would go toward the truthfulness of the defendant or the plaintiff as a witness. So that's pretty central to your case.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's hard for me to see how you would have any harm from calling attention to it by objecting to the way it was used in opening statement or final argument. If it's within the parameters of that ruling.
Well, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that to preserve this issue again, I don't think that we needed to object again to something that the district court had already said that they could do. In other words, the district court had said, you can call this guy a seven-time convicted felon. I don't think we have an obligation in that situation to object for a second or third time or every time that they make this reference. You know, the defense started with 16 straight questions.
So you're not arguing they misused the evidence. You're arguing that its admission in the first instance is the sole error.
Your Honor, that is correct. It's not that we're arguing that the defense did anything particularly inappropriate. It's that the district court erred in the first place, and that led to a sequence of events that ultimately led to our client being prejudiced at trial. And, Your Honor, just briefly touching on harmless error for a few more minutes. An error is harmless if the evidence was already overwhelming or one-sided. And the evidence was definitely not one-sided here. My client presented substantial independent evidence. He introduced photos taken right after the incident that showed cuts and wounds to his body and a puncture wound to his shoulder. He introduced testimony from his treating physician. He introduced medical records. All of that showed that he suffered wrist contusions, a cut to his abdomen, and a strained lumbar. My client also introduced eyewitness testimony from a neighbor down the street who witnessed the entire event. She testified that my client was manhandled. The jury found her testimony to be very important. They requested a copy of it during deliberations. By contrast, the defendants did not offer any independent testimony. Not one single independent witness testified on behalf of the defense. The defendants were relying solely on their own self-serving testimony. Under these circumstances, we feel that the evidence certainly was not one-sided and that the district court's error was therefore not harmless. I see I'm getting into my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve it.
Ms. Luce?
Good morning. May it please the court. This court has held that it is error not to put Rule 403 balancing on the record when that balancing is required. This morning I will address two reasons why that error is not grounds for reversal here. First, any argument that the evidence should have been excluded under the Rule 403 balancing has been waived, and second, the admission of the evidence was harmless error. As for waiver, Mr. Williams' motion in limine did not make an argument about the prejudicial effect of basic conviction information for convictions within the last 10 years.
Was it really necessary for plaintiff to say anything more about the probative prejudice balancing? Isn't the gist of plaintiff's argument obvious from the context? That is, that felony convictions are inflammatory and don't really reflect on truthfulness when they don't involve a lie?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that was not an argument that was advanced in the motion in limine. If we actually look at what was recited in that motion, the Rule 609 standard is set out, but then there were three paragraphs addressing specific arguments under 609, including an argument to keep out convictions that were older than 10 years, and there were a couple of paragraphs about limiting information with respect to convictions that were within the 10 years to the charges and sentencing information. The motion did not include an argument that even that limited amount of information had a prejudicial impact that substantially outweighed the probative value, such that the conviction should be kept out altogether. I would submit that is not even a skeletal argument for that. There are, after all, different grounds for objecting under Rule 609, that convictions are too old or that there's not that the crimes don't involve dishonesty or false statement, or that only limited information about the convictions should come in, or that the probative value is substantially outweighed by the prejudicial effect. Mr. Williams made a couple of those arguments, but not the latter one. When you object on one ground under Rule 609, that does not preserve an objection to the arguments on other grounds.
Isn't that more of a forfeiture than a waiver?
Yes, yes. I would say it's forfeiture for not raising it. That's correct. I wouldn't say it wasn't an affirmative statement, but it was completely leaving it out of the motion in limine and not giving either defense counsel an opportunity to respond to arguments that the prejudicial effect outweighed the probative value or an opportunity for the district court to rule on those arguments. If a litigant is going to challenge something that the district court did not do, did not consider with respect to the admission of evidence, of course the litigant needs to have made an adequate objection at some point before the appellate brief.
Well, and as I understand your argument, you're saying even if it was error by the district court, that the error was essentially harmless because of the overwhelming evidence that was presented here. But doesn't this case actually come down to a contest between the testimony of the four officers and Williams? And his past convictions were used to attack his credibility, so therefore the error would not be harmless.
Well, I would submit that the error is harmless. Of course, that boiled down to credibility is exactly why the convictions were admissible here. But as the appellant, Mr. Williams has the burden to show that the error was not harmless by showing a significant chance, when you look at the trial in this case, that the error affected the outcome of this trial. And, of course, this court does that by looking at the context of the trial and how that evidence was used. There was no parading lovingly of these convictions before the jury. There was no undue emphasis.
Well, you know, that opening statement is pretty outrageous, I think, to start out by saying you've got a seven-time convicted felon sitting here who will say or do anything to get money. That's
nevertheless
parading it, I think.
Number one, Ms.
Really,
of course,
brought it home to the jurors early in the case.
Should have exceeded what the judge did rule on the motion in limine. Should it have been used for an improper purpose in that argument, there was no objection. It was a brief comment, and it was fair to refer to the convictions for the purpose of attacking
that
Mr. Williams' credibility.
That he would do anything to get money in this case? Now,
that,
it's true they can reflect on his truthfulness, but...
Well, again, Mr. Williams certainly did not object that that comment about doing anything to get money exceeded the bounds of what was a proper use of the convictions, which we only sought to admit for purposes of impeachment.
I would just say there was some parading of those convictions around the courtroom.
That was a brief comment, and as the trial went on, those convictions were not harped on, especially when you look at what happened during cross-examination of Mr. Williams. Now, Mr. Williams' counsel...
Well, where did this comment take place in the opening? I thought it took place pretty early in the opening about the seven-time convicted felon.
I believe it did, but it was nevertheless one of numerous comments made in open argument about the evidence that would be forthcoming from defendant police officers.
But when you look at impact of things, I mean, the issue of primacy and recency, certainly the concept of primacy, what comes first out of the mouth of the lawyer arguing or in the early comments, may have a more significant impact than other things that follow. I mean, my guess is that's why it was put up right here at the beginning, to be able to call him a seven-time convicted felon who will say or do anything to get money.
Nevertheless, when you read the transcripts, I think overall it's easy to see that the felony convictions really did not turn out to be a central theme in this case. It was a point that was made about credibility, and the bulk of the trial was about the consistent testimony of the four police officers and Mr. Williams' testimony on the other side, which was called into question by much more than these convictions. it was called into question by drastically changing stories about what happened on the days in question. He added new and important details that hadn't been mentioned in his deposition or an investigation shortly after the incident. Defense counsel emphasized his demeanor on the stand and lack of corroboration for many of the important details of his testimony. And defense counsel made reference to one of the neighbors that testified, Ms. Willis, and I would submit that was not the corroborating evidence of what happened that day. Mr. Williams testified as an important key component to his excessive force claim that he was punched, that he was stabbed, and that he was maced in front of a crowd of people. But Ms. Willis testified that she didn't see any punching, she didn't see any stabbing or any macing, nor did she hear Mr. Williams yelling about that sort of conduct as he testified he had done. And as for the questions themselves about the convictions, those were the minimum number of questions just to get out the basic conviction information. Mr. Williams counted 16, but there would have been 7, but Mr. Williams couldn't remember and denied a couple, so there were a couple follow-ups. But even then, those questions only took up a few minutes of cross-examination and only elicited the basic information, the date, charges, and sentence of those convictions. As for the comments during closing argument, those do not demonstrate prejudicial effect of admitting the evidence either. The defense counsel briefly used the word convict, but immediately corrected himself, and his message was clear. He told the jury it should not accept the notion that it's okay to abuse a convicted felon. That's not a reason to find for the defendants here, but do consider the convictions in deciding whether to believe Mr. Williams. And as for the comment about jury instructions, I'd briefly note that, of course, Mr. Williams is not arguing that the absence of a limiting instruction should have is a basis to reverse, but that the argument incorrectly indicated that one would be coming. That did not add prejudicial effect to the admission of the convictions because the defense counsel was conceding and informing the jury it should consider convictions in assessing credibility, steering them away from an improper inference, not toward one. Your Honor, based on waiver and harmless error, we do ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
All right. Thank you. How much time? 2 minutes. Mr. Grabenstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. To sum up, I just want to emphasize how close of a case this was. It was a short 2-day trial, but the jury deliberated for 8 hours. During deliberations, they asked for a copy of Mrs. Willis's testimony. We presented substantial corroborating evidence at trial from independent witnesses, from a physician, from Ms. Willis. We also presented photos showing cuts and bruises to his body. In particular, the cuts, the bruises, the scars was very similar to the evidence that this court found sufficient in Lemons versus Skidmore, when it held that the error there was not harmless. They reasoned that was enough to go forward. It was enough that he had shown that he had had scars and injuries to his body. The other thing I just want to point out very quickly is that at page 9 of our brief, we do cite case law that says where you lose a motion in limine, you're not required to keep objecting throughout the course of the trial. And, of course, our position is that we lost the motion to limine, and we were not required to keep objecting if the defendants were within the parameters of that order.
Well, were you objecting at that point to the admission of the evidence itself or the use of that evidence?
In the motion to limine?
No, later on in the trial. What were your real problems with the use of the evidence, right?
It was, but we feel that they were within the parameters of the order. I mean, I guess I'm not sure whether evidence itself is damaging or the use. I would say they're one and the same. When you say someone's a 7-time convicted felon, it's the same. It's both a fact and the use.
Well, geez. You knew the evidence was coming in.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Your time is up. Were you appointed in this case?
We were appointed at the trial court level, Your Honor.
And at the Court of Appeals level?
No, Your Honor. We just continued with the case.
All right. Well, we want to thank you because we know you're not probably receiving any compensation. So this really is a pro bono representation.
Thank you.
We appreciate you taking the case and the vigorous defense you've provided. And always we appreciate the city's argument. And counsel. So thank you.